Today, the American paradox. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, working on the latest post covering finance and property news and other things. Today, I'm joined by our American in Oz, Salvador Babani.
Thank you. It's great to be back on the program.
Well, it's good to see you. And look, there's so much to talk about with regard to what's happening in America at the moment. I felt we should really just give it a bit of an airing because, you know, whichever way you look at it, it's really, really weird what's going on. Or is it?
Well, I would say weird, but not unprecedented. America, need I remind everybody, is a violent country. And while many of us, mourn the repeated outbursts of violence in America, they go back to, before the American Revolution. You may remember some rioters in Boston who dumped East India Company tea into Boston Harbor. And it's been going ever since. There's hardly been a break. Of course, after every outburst of violence, whether it's this one or a few years ago in Baltimore or a few years before that in Los Angeles, people think, this is going to change everything, but it rarely does. I mean, just to give you some idea of the state of normalcy in America, and I am going to call it that. On May 30th, an Australian analyst, some of your viewers may know, David Kilcullen, he's a prominent security analyst, he published an article in The Australian under the title, Home of the Hateful, Fearful, Heavily Armed, about how, in his experience, the United States was on the verge of the point when countries like Somalia, Yemen, and Sudan broke up due to the armed gangs, running loose without government control. Only his article was about gun nuts out in the mountains, not about riots in the cities. And of course, they had to insert a paragraph because the riots had just started that weekend. They had to insert a paragraph into the article saying, oh yes, in addition to separatist violence in Wyoming and Tennessee, there are also these riots going on. But he was ready, and The Australian was ready to publish a long format article in the Weekend Australian talking about how gun violence was going to turn America into a new Somalia before the riots. So take your pick. This has just been par for the course in American history for 300 years.
And obviously the starting point was the horrible death of the guy, but it seems to have morphed into a broader cry for the injustices that have been around for a long time. But again, I have to say, even I've noticed that it's not the first time that those cries have come to the surface and then dissipated again.
Right. Well, the George Floyd murder was especially brutal. Now, we don't actually even know whether it was a racially motivated murder. I know people don't like to hear that message, but apparently the officer had a long history of extreme violence when making arrests. Why he hadn't been fired previously, who knows? Yet, were those prior victims of his black or white or Hispanic or Asian? We don't know at this point. Now, I'm sure that will come out at some point with investigative reporting. Even if this was a racially motivated attack, I mean, every time a person of one race attacks a person of another race, it's not necessarily a racially motivated attack. Even if this was a racially motivated attack, that, of course, says very little about institutionalized racism and a lot about the officer involved. I mean, I've been reminding people, Minneapolis has been run by the Democratic Party for generations, not just the Democratic Party, one of the most progressive local Democratic parties. Its mayor is Jacob Frey, who is a Justin Trudeau lookalike and soundalike. Not only is he compared to just Justin Trudeau in looks, but in politics, he's extremely, I hate the term, but as people say, he's extremely woke. He's very much a social justice warrior. He was probably one of the most progressive big city mayors city mayors in the whole United States. On top of that, the city council is so progressive that in the wake of the riots, they have vowed to disband the entire Minneapolis police force, which, good luck with that. I mean, this is a city that is represented in Congress by Ilhan Omar, the Somali-American refugee, former refugee from Somalia, who has been extraordinarily controversial for her, you know, extremely left-wing, anti-Israel, you know, anti-establishment views. So if this is the location that people want to say is rife with institutionalized racism, you know, maybe it is, but then nowhere is safe. And the fact is, it's not just, you know, anti-racist rioting that happens in America. We've had we had a riot during the Obama administration, or not exactly a riot, but an uprising where a bunch of white separatists declared a national park in the West to be a sovereign republic. And Barack Obama, despite calls from many of us to send in the troops, that this just should not be tolerated, he didn't want violence, and so he let them take control of a national park. It wasn't news when it finally wound down. Honestly, I don't know what happened to the people who were involved, whether they were ever arrested or they were allowed to get away with it. And in the same way, now we see police standing by while statues are toppled, while, you know, Mahatma Gandhi's statue in Washington was vandalized. Well, what's anti-racist about vandalizing a Gandhi statue, of all things? You know, I think we just have to accept that America is and always has been a violent country, and look for the roots of the violence. That is, I don't see this current outbreak of, whether you want to call it demonstrations, or you want to call it looting, or you want to call it riots, it's all three combined. But I don't see that as anything particularly different in the history of the United States.
So what is the sociological driver behind it then? Because there's clearly something in, you know, the right DNA of the country that just seems to accept and allow this to happen.
Well, the customary explanation is the frontier thesis, the idea that the United States was born in violence on the frontier. I know there's been a big move by critical race theorists to try to make this all about the birth of America and slavery. In fact, the New York Times has bought onto that with its slavery project, trying to argue the United States was born in slavery. I think it's much more reasonable to say the United States was born in frontier warfare. That is, throughout the entire country, not just in the South. There was extreme violence on the frontier, extreme violence towards Native Americans, who were often lost in the shuffle in all this. In Australia, Aboriginal Australians, of course, are very prominent in Australia's race debates. But in the United States, despite the fact that Native Americans make up a similar proportion of the U.S. population as do Native Australians in Australia, it's simply swept under the carpet in all of the attention paid to race. Yet it was the frontier that was extraordinarily violent. It was the frontier, that constant pushing westward, that led to people being, you know, always armed and ready. The first riots or the first revolts against the United States government took place in the frontier. Shays' Rebellion in the western Massachusetts frontier took place before the Constitution was even ratified. Shortly after the ratification of the Constitution, there was the Whiskey Rebellion in western Pennsylvania and western Virginia. And it's never really stopped since then. And I should emphasize, on all sides. So we could see, as the precedents for today's anti-racism protests, in the run-up to the Civil War, there were white Northerners who snuck into southern border towns and burned down police stations and freed slaves. Now, the verdict of history has been on their side. Well, they were fighting in a just cause. Well, the cause was just, but was the burning down of police stations the right tactic? That's open to question. And I think in the same way today, you know, very few people doubt the justice of the cause of protesting against racism. But there are many of us who rebel at the idea of just hitching your tractor to a statue and pulling it down because you've decided that. That said, all sides, right? When the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, well, you know, this was the U.S. forces who helped. They were desperately looking for some Iraqi demonstrators who could help them pull down the statue of Saddam Hussein, so it wouldn't look like it was the United States Army doing it. Well, you know, as you reap, so shall you sow. The chickens come home to roost, etc. Look, I'm not connecting what is happening now in the United States to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I am connecting it to 300 years of a heritage of violence, of citizen self-action, of people deciding they're going to take things into their own hands, whether that's you know, people like John Brown, who was, you know, idolized in before the Civil War for trying to start a slave revolt. Of course, he killed lots of innocent people and innocent soldiers in his attempt to start a slave revolt. Or on the other side, whether it has been the lynchings of African Americans throughout the South, throughout the, you know, from the 1860s, well, after slavery, I mean, through slavery, lynchings were legal, right? And then after slavery, throughout the South, all the way up until the late 1960s, really until the early 1970s, African Americans were routinely lynched by mobs who took justice into their own hands. Now, again, I want to be clear. I don't endorse that. I don't believe in that. I just see that as part and parcel of American-style democracy.
And what about the Confederacy flag? It seems to now that that's even got a bit of a bite to it.
The Confederate flag debate has been going on, of course, since the Civil Rights era. Mm. It's one that never goes away. Maybe it will go away now if all Confederate flags are put away. Look, America is a country that is founded on the principle of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. Yet, that freedom of speech is more effectively controlled by public opinion than it is by law. Now, of course, anybody who wants to fly a Confederate flag absolutely has the right to do so, just like people who are protesting have the right to burn the American flag if they want to. It's actually not even a right. I should use the proper language. It's a freedom. That is, there's no law that says you may burn specific flags. It's a freedom that says, well, the government can't stop you from expressing your desire to speak. However, your neighbors can stop you. And that's what we see happening with the Confederate flag debate. We see people being treated as social pariahs if they want to display a Confederate flag. Now, of course, that's been an evolving transition in the United States. When I was a kid, the most popular show on TV was The Dukes of Hazzard, and Dukes of Hazzard drove a car that had a Confederate flag on the side of it called the General Lee, that when it honked its horn, it honked Dixie. And that was just a charming, charming Southern local color bit to a fun comedy show with lots of cars getting wrecked. Today, it probably is banned from video streaming services, I would bet, because of the Confederate allusions. Now, it's not banned by the U.S. government. And that's the crucial thing. I mean, whether I agree or disagree, frankly, I think it's ridiculous that people think the Dukes of Hazzard or Gone with the Wind should be banned. A personal totem of mine has been Showboat. Showboat was a movie made, the original Showboat was made in the 1950s, or not late 1940s, I believe. Earlier even, which was an anti-racism movie showing the racism of the Old South. It starred Paul Robeson, who was like one of the greatest civil rights leaders in American history. Not only a civil rights leader, a committed Marxist who visited the Soviet Union. I mean, Paul Robeson was as hardcore anti-establishment as you could get. Yet, because Paul Robeson repeatedly uses the N-word in that movie, it has been banned from US TV, from video distribution services. You can get a pirate copy on YouTube, but you can't buy a DVD. Now, this is a movie that was made as an anti-racism movie. Yet, because of that talismanic use of the N-word, it can't be shown. Not because it's against the law, but because public opinion has condemned it. Now, again, I don't think that's rational. I don't think that's right. I think that's part and parcel of American-style democracy. And actually, I may double down on that. If you go back to Democracy in America, which was the famous book by Alexis de Tocqueville, written in 1834, in Democracy in America, de Tocqueville said that in America there was less free speech than in France. Now, in the France of his day, there was an official censor. Anything you wanted to publish, you had to get approved by the censor. He said, but with an official censor, an intellectual like me, I can always write a parable. I can always find a way to get around the censor. You know, intelligent men can always find a way to agree that so that the people, so that the people won't be infected by our intellectual discourse. He thought that that was fine. The problem in America was everyone was free to say what they wanted, but public opinion would come down upon you like a load of bricks. And so he actually thought America was less free than a country where you weren't given any freedom of speech at all than France. And that's the conundrum here. John Stuart Mill said the same thing. In On Liberty, John Stuart Mill said that although he was against either forceful or public opinion based, either state or public opinion based repression of freedom of speech. He thought that public opinion based repression was the more dangerous of the two. Now, we all remember John Stuart Mill on liberty. You know, people should be free to do what they want as long as they don't harm their neighbors. But Mill was actually more concerned about the coercive impact of public opinion than he was about the coercion of the police.
And I guess, linking public opinion and, behavior and stuff, we should just touch on Trump and his walk to the ruined church, because I think that's quite an iconic event, and it's actually not necessarily playing out perhaps the way he thought it would.
Well, he wanted to play it as him piously visiting a church when everyone knows that Trump is not a pious man. I mean, it's in a way it was almost a joke, but played out poorly with whom? I mean, you always have to ask with what audience. Trump's audience for that was not the people protesting in the streets. And the fact that he's been condemned by America's intellectual establishment really is neither here nor there for Trump. The question is, what do the, what do the silent Americans think? And that we won't know until Election Day. And honestly, I don't know the answer to that, because none of us know what people are thinking in their hearts, until they have a chance to express it in the secret ballot at the ballot box. Right now, we know that the people who are especially loud are anti-Trump. We know the people who are concerned about public opinion. So the general who took the walk with him has apologized and said that he shouldn't have done it. But, it's a good sign when in a democracy, even a military general is worried about public opinion. Now, this is not an elected official. He doesn't have to worry about that, but he does worry about that. Now, these are signs, I think, of a healthy democracy. Again, I don't endorse them. if Trump wants to walk to a church, he should be able to do it in peace without protesters blocking his path. I think we have legal mechanisms for protest in democracies where you're supposed to get a license, notify people you're protesting, have a planned route. It is not legal in the United States, or dare I say in Australia, for you simply to decide that you're having a protest even though you've been denied a permit. That's not legal in either country. So, this isn't about what's legal and illegal. This is about what plays well at the ballot box versus what doesn't. And we won't know that till November.
And then the last point on this one is Biden came out and basically said he felt that Trump would try and stay in the White House. What was that about?
Oh, look, I don't know. There's been a lot of talk in Democratic circles about the possibility that Trump is going to stage a coup, that he is not going to allow an election in November. We've been hearing that for 4 years. Democracy has ended in the United States. If that were true, it would have been true at the midterm elections, which in 2018, Trump would have declared invalid so that he could retain control of the House of Representatives. Look, all of this, I mean, if you want to go back, I should get my sunglasses back and we can go back to conspiracy theories. If anything, the U.S. deep state is so thoroughly anti-Trump that the idea that Trump could stage a coup is simply laughable. I mean, Trump is only in office because, despite the trenchant opposition of all of the state machinery of the United States, in the end, we respect election results, and even a questionable election result in which someone wins by the rules but loses the popular vote, still, we're a law-abiding country, and the rule of law ultimately prevails. Now, I have to stress ultimately, because the rule of law obviously is not prevailing on the streets in the United States. Protesters do not have protest license. I want to be clear, no one wants to say this because commentators feel like the protesters are on the right side of history, but virtually all of these are illegal protests that in ordinary times would get you arrested, that if the cause were unsympathetic, if someone wanted to stage a counter protest against the protests, they'd be arrested for illegal protesting if they didn't have a permit. If someone tried to disrupt one of these illegal protests, they'd get arrested. I think we really need to keep in mind the rule of law, bends but doesn't break in the United States. And it bends all the time, sometimes towards the wrong side of history, lynchings in the South in the civil rights era, sometimes towards the right side of history. Look, I think you, I, and everyone listening is an anti-racist. I mean, none of us are in favor of racism. And if you ask who's in the right side of history, people who are protesting racism or those who are racists, clearly the anti-racists are on the right side of history. But that doesn't mean that the graffiti artists, the looters, the arsonists are on the right side of history. And let's be clear, I mean, it's only a matter of time before one of these arsons kills somebody, if it hasn't already. Arson, you know, fire is a very dangerous weapon in the hands of an illegal protest.
Well, I found this a really fascinating conversation, and I think it really does come back to the paradox that we mentioned at the beginning, right? Because I think some of the mainstream media reporting has been very myopic, and the nuances you've been able to bring to the discussion today, I really appreciate.
Well, it really is a paradox, and let me compare it. I mean, if I can take one more minute of your viewers' time, let me compare it to the internet paradox. The internet is a massive paradox in that it's a decentralized system. You know, no one controls it. It's highly vulnerable. There are millions of security flaws, and yet it continues to work, despite the fact that it wasn't designed by anyone. And in this, it's a highly chaotic, anarchic place with lots of hackers, lots of evildoers, lots of people who want to bring it down. And yet, look, we're talking on the internet right now. And in the same way, American democracy is a paradox in that, you know, yes, there are armed groups out in the Mountain West, and yes, there are violent arsonists in the inner cities, and yes, there are racists embedded in institutions, and you know, there are all these flaws. You know, but it's been 250 years, and the system still works. And I think that's really what is the proof is in the pudding. You know, if you were to design an internet from top down, you would not design the internet today, but you'd design something that was not nearly as good. And in the same way, if you were to design American democracy top down, it might look great on paper, but it probably wouldn't work as well as American democracy has worked for nearly 250 years.
Thank you so much for that thought, and appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Martin.
Take care. Bye-bye.